From the studios of WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Many of us have heard that playing Mozart for a baby in utero can help with brain development. We've heard plants do better when classical music is played versus hard rock. We've seen reports that classical music can help medical patients heal faster. There was even a piece about how classical music can relax your dog. But for those who weren't raised with classical music, or who are not musicians themselves, the genre can seem daunting, exclusive, maybe even boring. And maybe just for old people. Today, please use my expansive ignorance as your gateway. We'll kick open the door to classical music for all those who may perhaps have been intrigued, but embarrassed that they couldn't explain what a movement is or why people don't clap in between them. This is not a scholarly show for those steeped in the tradition. The dumb questions we entertain today might frustrate, even enrage, classical music aficionados, so you can reprogram your radio right now to HQR's classical channel at 92.7. And now I am so pleased to welcome two fine musicians and educators about classical music. Barbara McKenzie is the artistic director of Chamber Music Wilmington, and she is a classical pianist in her own right. Barbara McKenzie, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. It's glad to be here.
We are also very glad to have WHQR. Yeah, let's try that again, those call letters that I never say. WHQR's own program manager and music director, Bob Workman.
Hi, welcome. Rachel.
Glad to have you here, Bob. You're usually across the hall right now.
Mm.
And we are inviting you to join the conversation. If you have a question about classical music, give us a call today at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. No questions are dumb questions today. But if you're shy, feel free to use a fake name. Putting this together, guys, I came to realize that the intersection of people who know nothing about classical music but are interested versus those who don't know and don't care is probably pretty small. So if someone thinks, let's start with this, that they're not interested in this genre, it just kind of bores them. It's what their grandparents listened to. How would you create an entry point in their thinking, Barbara McKenzie?
Well, that's a great question because we've been wrestling with that since I founded Chamber Music Wilmington. And I think just getting people in the door. And so to do that, we get to make it fun and accessible and interactive is one of the new things that is very popular, you know. But I have a little anecdote, a little story to tell. I was rehearsing at the chapel, Keenan Chapel, with my piano trio, and it was just a Monday morning, and these three older women came in, and they were just looking at the chapel, and they sat and listened to us, and when we took a break, one of the women stood up, and she said, "Well, what kind of music is that?" And I said, Well, that's a trio. That's a Beethoven trio, and it's called chamber music." And she said, "Well, I like chamber music." and I think that's, you know, I don't know, there's something about that word, chamber or classical. You know, we need to figure out another way to refer to this genre, maybe. You know, maybe we call it art music. I mean, people don't freeze when they think about going to an art museum. And you see lots of ages and all sorts of sizes of ages and levels of appreciator, people who appreciate the arts, aficionados and beginners. And they go to the art museum. And
right.
So maybe we need to refer to this kind of music as art music or heart music. I don't know.
Chamber. I mean, you know, there's chamber pot. There's the legislature. So it's either political
or torture chamber.
Right, there you go.
If you really have a negative view of classical music.
So what is chamber music? How is that different from what we call the big umbrella of classical?
Well, okay. So if I say to someone who's new to my kind of music and they say, "Well, what do you do?" And I say, "Well, let me ask you, do you like to experience music in an intimate setting where you're close to the artist or the performers or musicians?" And most people say, well, yeah, that sounds really cool. And I go, and do you like it when people play something and they really put their heart and soul into it and it's, you know, passionate expression for them? They go, yeah, I can really dig that. I can really get into that. And I say, well, okay, then come check it out, because that's what classical chamber music is about. It's not a spectacle. It's you get really, you know, caught up in the energy because you're so close and watching the artists communicate the way they do. You know, it's like if you like watching baseball players interact and all those subtle little hand signals and eye contacts and body movements, that's no different than what classical artists on stage do.
Well, what you're describing is something that's very much alive. And Bob Workman, when I first came to you with this idea, doing a coastline about an entryway into classical music for people who aren't familiar with it and might find it boring, I asked you about the North Carolina Symphony, and I asked you about the players there, because my husband and I have gone several times, and I think they're the most dour, depressed, bored, possibly angry looking group of musicians. It's hard for me to understand how you can be playing music from supposedly some of the greatest composers in the world and have that non-expression on your face, your eyes fixed on a page. It doesn't feel alive at all, although it sounds alive if you close your eyes. Why do they look like that, Bob?
I'm glad you're answering that question.
Okay.
They've driven from Raleigh to Wilmington.
Oh, you're answering the question. Okay. Go right ahead, Barbara.
Sorry.
That's quite all right. They've driven all the way from Raleigh. And in fact, they probably are very tired. They play out. That's probably the third concert that they've played out from Raleigh. That means they drive somewhere. They get on a bus and they go somewhere and have that concert. They also have to adjust to circumstances that sometimes are not ideal, although that's probably changed considerably since the Wilson Center has come into existence. There's also the fact that maybe there's a soloist involved and they haven't had that many rehearsals and they have to pay very close attention to what's going on in a way that they didn't have to in the last performance. There are all sorts of mitigating factors, and there's also the cultural aspect, the culture of the organization itself, which may lend itself to misery or to great enthusiasm for what they're doing. But I think if you look closely, you can still sense the communication going on between the musicians that are on stage. I don't know that they actually think at times in terms of the fact that they are on stage performing in front of an audience in a way that we would think of as a performance. It's not theater for them.
But doesn't music make – okay, Yo-Yo Ma, he's a guy who plays the cello. Some people have heard of him, and some people have been lucky enough to see him play. He played with the North Carolina Symphony, and he was a striking contrast with the musicians. And I don't mean in terms of expertise, but his whole body was moving. His eyes were not on the page, and he was forcing this other cellist in the symphony to look at him, and he was moving towards her. And finally, she connected with him, and then suddenly there was this very alive thing happening between the two of them. But Barbara McKenzie, why doesn't that happen all the time?
Thanks, Bob. You really brought it to light that it is a big organization. You may not like the stand partner that you're sharing your score with. You may have issues. I mean, there's a lot of personality stuff. This is a corporate setting. People don't know that. And also, you know, when you're a soloist, when you're Yo-Yo Ma or you're playing with a piano trio or, say, a string quartet, you are the effect, the success of that performance depends on the four of you or the three of you really making it work. So you have to listen and combine your efforts. When you're playing in an orchestra, you've got this conductor there, and a lot of musicians just kind of get lazy and let him run the program, you know, indicate all of the dynamic markings, the tempos, everything. And so they just kind of get lazy. Do you agree, Bob?
Why can they phone it in if, say, Bob, a singer, cannot? If you're up there singing an aria, you need to be feeling what's going on. Otherwise, it's not...
To a certain extent, yeah. You can't let yourself have all the feels because then you wouldn't be able to perform. I've come near to tears performing before, and it renders you incapable of making a sound that is worthy of the music you're trying to sing. You can't let the emotion overtake you, but you have... It's like you can have the emotion, but you cannot let it overtake the performance of the music itself. The music itself, there are certain demands. The notes have to be in the right order, at the right tempo.
The right notes.
The right notes. All those things have to happen because that's what the composer gave you. That's what's causing the emotion. All those things combine into what's causing you to have those feelings.
So then talk to us about classical music pieces are broken into what you guys call movements. What exactly is a movement, and why are we supposed to be quiet in between them?
Well, I mean, classical music, that's one of the interesting differences between classical music or art music and pop music is just the very duration. I think jazz... You know, improv sometimes gets up to 5 or 6 minutes for a short, piece they're doing. But classical music can be as long as 60 minutes or 45 minutes. And sometimes it's broken into different sections, and there's contrast in those sections. So you're going to have something slow and then something fast and then something slow again and end with a bang sometimes, right? So you end with your excitement. And,
We're going to hear more about that when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's classical music for non-classical people today. We're opening the door to all those questions you've always wondered about but would never ask in the presence of an aficionado. Barbara McKenzie of Chamber Music Wilmington and WHQR's Bob Workman are with us today. They're being very gentle and welcoming, so ask the question, use a fake name if you must. But if you're wondering it, many other people probably are too. The phone number is 910-343-1138. Email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You are listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. If you've ever wondered about how classical music and how some people just seem to be born into understanding it, while others, like you maybe, feel it's a language no one ever taught you to speak, we're here to change that today. WHQR's music director, Bob Workman, and Chamber Music Wilmington's Barbara McKenzie are here today to answer all those questions you've always wanted to ask. No question is too pedestrian, and snobs are not welcome today. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And in a moment, we're going to talk to Guillaume from Whiteville. But first, just before we went to break, we were talking about what movements are. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask our engineer, Caleb Covington, to cue up a piece, the final movement of Shostakovich. That's 5. That is not the first one that we talked about. And I'll ask Bob and Barbara to kind of get into the background for this. Barbara, can you explain why this piece needs to be broken up into movements and what it's about? What story does it tell?
Okay, so, well, first of all, movements are just different sections in a larger whole. Okay, so that's, instead of calling it a section 2, we call it the second movement. And
so like acts in a play.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And exactly. And so, you know, unlike a play, when there's a closing bit at the end of the first act, you applaud, right?
Right.
And so, but there are a lot of scenes in that act, right?
Very much so.
And we don't usually applaud between the scenes because there's still action. And in between movements, sometimes the movements, there's an atmosphere that you want to hold between, say, the first and second movement, or the second and third movement. And artists are are really cool with people applauding between there between those movements. However, the tradition became not to applaud because you don't want to disturb the artist's concentration and you don't want to disturb the atmosphere. So for people who are going, oh, God, that's one of those things, I just never know when to applaud, you know, your appreciation is always welcome by the artist on stage.
It's true. Yeah.
And, you know, an artist more and more are getting more casual about if you feel if you're moved to applaud, then so be it. Go for it. You know, I'd like to know you're out there and appreciating this. And yeah, Bob, is there anything you want to add to that? Because
no, that's a very, very fine explanation of what a movement does and how it functions in a piece of classical music that has movements.
And
not all of them do.
And artists can really help the audience. You know, if I'm playing a solo piece and I don't want someone to clap after the end of a movement, my body language and my hands, I can just hold it so that people know, oh, I'm paying attention. There's something happening here. And then I'll go into the next bit or the next piece, the next movement, and then they relax because they go, oh, yeah, I see she was setting that up.
And those are some sensitive people maybe in a chamber music setting. Mm-hmm. At a recent performance, I think this would have been Beethoven's 9th with the North Carolina Symphony.
Oh, yeah, I was there.
There was a moment between movements. It was silent. And then somebody started to clap, and then a few other people sounded uncertain, and then pretty soon the room breaks out, and Grant Llewellyn, the conductor, he straightens up. And if you could have put a soundtrack to what he was feeling, it might have been,
yeah.
Come on, you guys. And then he turned around and smiled sort of sheepishly.
And it's a matter of personal approach on the part of a conductor usually. Yeah. You know, it's there's a continuing thought. What Barbara just expressed is like the thought in that the previous movement, you want it to carry through into what's about to happen. And very much so with Beethoven's 9th Symphony because it's a cyclical symphony. The themes all connect to one another. Everything just unfolds and keeps and they return. These themes keep coming back. And, you know, you talked about how people get into classical music. Oftentimes a story helps make that possible. And in the case of the Shostakovich Fifth Symphony, for example, he had just written an opera called Lady Macbeth of Mtsinsk. This is 1935. And he got into so much trouble for this piece because even though Joseph Stalin, who was the leader of the Soviet Union at the time, initially liked it, he was convinced that it was basically the same thing Hitler called Jewish art, degenerate art. It was expressionist. It was like listening to a Picasso painting. It was and Shostakovich had to atone for this. And his atonement was to write the Symphony No. 5, which was, you could argue, very much in the vein of Beethoven's Symphony No. 5 in terms of its majesty, its power. And it's one of these strange things of someone complying with the wishes of the authorities and at the same time rebelling against them. It's an incredible piece of music. The first time I heard this piece of music, by the way, was it was played by a university marching band at halftime during a Penn State game. I want to say they were playing against, I don't know, it was a bowl game. Maybe they were playing Alabama or something like that. But it was played during halftime by a marching band.
I can't imagine.
The whole piece?
This part of this movement.
This final
movement of the Symphony No. 5.
So Caleb has this queued up. So tell us before we go into it, what is happening in this final movement? I mean, can we get that literal? You painted the picture of how this music emerged from Shostakovich. It's basically a passive-aggressive piece is what
you
said.
And
a rebellion.
You can almost hear it in the rhythm of the piece. It's like, I will obey, I will obey. And at the same time, you could flip that on his ear and say, I will survive, I will survive. It's like, I will overcome this through my art in some way. I'm giving you what you want, boss, but here's what I really think.
Okay, let's listen.
Thank you.
And Bob, could you just back announce this piece?
Yeah, sure. This is Mstislav Rostropovich conducting the National Symphony Orchestra in the last movement of Shostakovich's Symphony No. 5. Dmitri Shostakovich.
It's a fantastic recording.
Barbara McKenzie.
Yeah. Well, I was just, taking some notes to share with our listeners. So that piece, if you just walk in and hear it, like maybe people just did, cold, I mean, you relate to the energy. There is so much excitement. You've got all of these brass instruments just playing full out, and it's exciting. And then yet you also notice, even I think a novice notices, there's some darker undertone there.
Yeah.
And that reminds me that, we are surrounded in our culture by classical music, right? It's on the radio. It's on TV. It's in commercials all the time. And we don't really know that we're listening to Bach. You know, there was a really popular advertisement a couple years ago, life insurance, that was the cutest thing. You know, a little boy and an older man, you could see their hands, and they were playing a Bach invention together. And, it became a very well-known Bach invention. But we are surrounded by classical music, and you may have heard that in a commercial that Shostakovich.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Go ahead, Bob.
You just mentioned commercials, cartoons. There are all these different ways that we don't realize are gateways into an entire musical world that is so immense and powerful.
Mm.
It's funny at the time, perhaps, and clever and all that, but it's so much more than that. And it's, I don't know, I think it's kind of a voyage of discovery. You hear something you like and you want to hear more of it. And it's okay to allow yourself to be overcome by it, too, you know. And I'm sorry.
That is the beauty of attending, I think, a live performance, whether it's the orchestra concert or a chamber music concert or a vocal recital. Is that when the artist is really doing their job, you are caught up in the huge range of emotion, right? Classical music represents and portrays and touches every human emotion.
Yeah.
Right? And maybe, when you think, oh my gosh, could I really sit still for 8 minutes and hear a piece by Beethoven, for example, or Chopin? Well, the answer is yes, because that time, if you're listening, and that is the challenge in our busy world, is that we can look at classical concerts as a way to really give ourselves a moment of repose and reflection and stillness and listening. And, we're so distracted. That's just what's happening in our world. We're very distracted people now.
A piece called The Awfulness of Classical Music Explained says Joseph Horowitz, in his wonderful new book, Moral Fire, describes audiences screaming and standing on chairs during classical concerts in the 1890s. The New York Times records an audience that wept and shouted, strung banners across the orchestra pit over the heads of the audience, and flapped unrestrainedly when listening to their favorite opera singer at the Met in the 1920s. Today, this writer says, smugness. Yes, I'm sorry, that's there. As a non-aficionado, I feel it. Dullness, an overabundance of ritualism, everything, in fact, that Beethoven would have hated. Bob Workman, what do you say to that? Am I hurting your feelings?
No.
Not at all, no. We touched on this a moment ago, and, when artists do appreciate an audience responding to what they do. And yes, there are certain conventions. One doesn't expect, for example, to hear applause after one sings a recitative, which is like basically setting up the story you're about to tell in singing an aria. One doesn't expect applause between that recitative and the aria itself when we're talking about vocal music. And yet when it happens, it can be a delightful thing. You've performed a recitative beautifully, and hopefully you'll sing that aria just as beautifully. I guess what I'm sensing is that a lot of listeners feel ostracized by the aficionado culture of classical music. Would you say that's a fair statement?
Well, say more about that.
I think you know, that experience of you're going to the symphony concert by the North Carolina Symphony and Mr. Llewellyn seeming with his body language to not appreciate the applause of the audience at that point in the concert. And we've talked about why he maybe did not want anything to happen at that point. Nevertheless, an emotional response was elicited by the music that was performed just prior to that. I don't think people should be discouraged. I don't think audiences should be discouraged from responding to music in the way that they feel it.
We have an email from Brian. He writes, several years ago, I had the opportunity to see a live hip-hop show with a 13-piece supporting orchestra with a conductor and everything you would see at a classical music concert. The name of the group was Deltron 3030. They definitely looked like they were having a good time.
Yeah.
have either of you heard of this?
No.
Group? Yeah, but I think hip-hop groups always look like they're having good time.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, again, it's such a different culture, the orchestra, as opposed to small ensembles or quartets.
That's very true.
Yeah. Quartets, especially the young quartets, who are really hot and winning prizes and traveling and are young and, you know, making a great career, they are just so awesome on stage. And the older guys are still thinking, when are we going to get out of the concert so I can go get my stage?
It shows.
I know it shows.
It does.
I know. But okay, so we present, a lot of ensembles, and that's what I'm looking for. I don't want to hire the old established ensemble that can't wait to get out for dinner. You know, I want somebody that's really excited about that, you know, Schumann quartet they're performing.
You're listening to Coastline. It's classical music for those who are not born into it, but who may harbor some curiosities that they haven't gotten the opportunity to explore. With us to answer your questions on this Thursday, Barbara McKenzie, classical pianist and artistic director of Chamber Music Wilmington, and Bob Workman, program director and music director for WHQR. You can ask your own question by calling us today at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Guillaume from Whiteville, welcome to Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What's your question?
Well, it's not really a question. It's more of a comment. And Barbara and Bob talked about it. They brushed it a little bit. Basically, I just want to tell people, you know, yeah, classical music can be very intimidating. You know, what's with the name? Sometimes, you know, something is an opus or whatever. And that can be intimidating to some people. But really, we are surrounded by classical music all the time. And especially if you go to the movies, you know, if you've watched the last Star Wars movie, that movie is 2 hours and 20 minutes of classical music. And you just sit there and you've got music with the images, but it's really classical music. John Williams writes classical music. So does Hans Zimmer in other movies. You know, if you've seen Jurassic Park or if you've seen any of the action movies lately, the background is classical music. And I just want to tell the younger people today, don't feel intimidated. If you like that kind of music, then go ahead and listen to it and buy the soundtrack or get to know about the soundtrack and what else moves these people who compose those kind of music, and you might actually get into it.
Guillaume, are you a musician?
Yeah.
Yeah. How did I know? What do you play?
I play the piano pretty poorly, but I play it.
Oh. Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate you calling in. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about classical music for non-aficionados. The dumber you think your question is, the more you probably need to ask it. 910-343-1138 is how you can do that. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Tom writes, in the last several decades, with the advent of what we may call modern music, like country, rock and roll, soft rock, R&B, heavy metal, folk, I'm not aware of any different classifications of classical music, except by the composer. Over the centuries, have variations of classical music fallen into different categories that I'm just not aware of?
Sure.
Barbara.
I mean, when you hear people talk about Baroque music, classical music is actually, we refer to the period when Mozart and Haydn and Beethoven were writing. And then, of course, Romantic music is coming into Chopin and Schumann and Brahms. And then we talk about modern music in classical music, And modern music is anything that happened, I don't know, what, Bob, early 1900s. And I was thinking about the, you know, the Rite of Spring, when they had Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, the opening concert. People came with fruit and vegetables, Rachel, to the concert hall to throw. I mean, it was a huge scandal. So, yeah, that we call the period starting with the last century modern music, and now, you know, contemporary music, and there's lots of different kinds of so-called classical music within these different periods in time. There's a timeline, and we do identify the music with these terms.
Yeah, you know, we love to categorize things and put things in boxes, but the fact is, you know, and even as thorny a composer as Arnold Schoenberg knew that he owed a tremendous debt to everything that came before him. And he tried to distill it to its essence in his own mind and what he tried to do as a composer, which is a whole other very deep well we don't want to go in down right now. But I will say that Guillaume had a really excellent point in that about the gateway to music of various kinds. Movie music is one of those places, I think, and especially in American culture, where we have a bridge to all that music that came before, and it synthesizes not only the European so-called classical tradition, but the music that we think of as America's classical music, jazz, blues, and all of these things have – there are all these connections to all kinds of different cultures. It's so expansive. You can't – I don't think it's fair to really isolate these things, and that's why I do what I do on the radio. I try to explore musical styles that one doesn't necessarily think of as classical music.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a classical music demystification ceremony today. Every dumb question you've ever wanted to ask, we want to hear. The dumber, the better. We're coming in through the front door today, 910-343-1138 or coastline at whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. On today's edition, we're doing our best to demystify classical music. With us to answer any question you might have wondered about but haven't dared to ask in the presence of classical music aficionados, we have Barbara McKenzie here. She's a classical pianist and the artistic director of Chamber Music Wilmington. Also with us today, WHQR's program director and music director, Bob Workman, who also happens to be a very fine opera singer. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. We have an anonymous email. This says, I once saw a piano concert at a local college. At the end of the first movement, the president of the college rushed on stage with a bunch of flowers. The soloist had to violently wave him back so she could finish. The president of a college. Well, that probably makes a lot of us feel better that he misjudged the timing.
Well, I was a visiting artist in a visiting artist program here in North Carolina, and the host college president, I said, well, do you have a concert quality instrument? And he says, honey, we've got a great instrument. In fact, it's plugged in out there, and the guy told me we never have to tune it. and I just kind of went, oh, the mission work starts at the top.
Random question. Do the musicians in the North Carolina Symphony make a living at it?
Yes.
Okay, so
yes,
they don't have to do other things. The chairs, the seating arrangements.
They still do other things. And most musicians teach and gig like crazy, which means pickup work. But yeah.
Okay.
But they do make a living.
So we know that orchestras are arranged in terms of skill. The first chair, first chair violin, is the most skilled senior person,
or that position opened up when he was looking for a job, and he just happened to be very lucky that day.
Really?
I mean, yeah.
So does it not mean, like, if you look at the person in the back on the last row, is that the worst person in the orchestra?
Not
and is that embarrassing?
Not necessarily. It might be the young 18-year-old who is just picking up work until he can find an audition and win a position, right? So
there's a hierarchy in orchestras.
There definitely.
Yeah. I mean, you have to graduate to the status of concertmaster or first stand or whatever.
So then how does the conductor figure out who gets seat number 12 and who gets number 13?
You audition for that spot.
Okay, so the seats are jobs that are open.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
And there are only so many.
Now, what is the job of the conductor during a concert? It looks to those non-musicians of us who know nothing about this like it's a lot of performance art, and that's what I would like to be doing during the concert. But is there any substance there? Do you need the conductor during the concert? Has he not communicated his vision of the piece in rehearsal? Barbara McKenzie.
You have an opinion, I'm sure.
Well, you know, I remember just asking conductors not to conduct here because I found it really distracting. You know, in a larger ensemble, say, you know, nine people, for example. Smaller ensembles, you don't really need a conductor because you're feeling it and breathing it. And so that's why when you go to chamber music concerts or, you know, anything with two people to 12 or 14 or 16 people even, or even like the Orpheus String Quartet, not Orpheus, what is the ensemble in New York?
Without
Orpheus.
A conductor, the Orpheus.
Orpheus. Absolutely. It's a chamber ensemble, chamber orchestra of maybe 24 people on average. And they take pride in the fact that they don't use a conductor, which means that they've been able to negotiate all the musical intersections and interpretations really well. And you get to be in that orchestra when you're not only a stellar performer, but you're also a good negotiator, and you give and take. And it's like running a very intricate, high-powered business where everybody really is a team to make that work. Like programming, for example, where you have multiple programmers. They all have to communicate really well to make it work.
It's a flat organizational chart, which is, you know, most businesses cannot function that way or don't want to function that way.
Well, in the North Carolina Symphony, to keep using this in the, as an example, hope Grant Llewellyn never listens to this. Bob, in rehearsal then, so Beethoven's Ninth is coming up, and Grant Llewellyn comes in and he says, right, well, this is my vision for the piece.
Exactly. And he's the five-star general.
So then how does – what happens in the performance? Do have the musicians – what do the musicians understand? Do they need him up there? I'm sorry. See, it's a dumb question.
That is a very – that's a loaded question because
seriously,
a lot of musicians would tell you, we don't really care for the conductor. If he could just step away, we would be so much more alert and on our toes, right?
Yeah.
Yep. That's a big age-old thing. That is a thing between the musicians.
So there's tension. There.
Yeah, and then you have great conductors like a Toscanini or a Karajan, von Karajan, who they were the five-star generals. You did not buck them, and if you didn't please them, you were not long in that chair, in that position.
It's true. Toscanini in particular was known for an incredibly volatile temper. Fritz Reiner was probably the meanest.
Aggressive.
I mean,
stories like
horrifying.
Dear Woman or Ormandy was not.
Eugene Ormandy,
And there are probably conductors today who maybe don't have
these
quite
people,
the nasty reputations that they
do.
These are all dead guys, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so Fritz Reiner, the super meanie, conducted the
Chicago Symphony Orchestra was his greatest gig.
Yeah, George Sell.
George Sell, Cleveland Orchestra.
There's a great joke about that sort of expresses how musicians feel about conductors, that someone dies and goes to heaven. Let's say it's Yo-Yo Ma. Okay, make it contemporary. He dies and goes to heaven, and say Peter meets him at the gate, and he says, oh, I can't wait to get to the orchestra. He takes him up, and he says, oh, well, who's conducting? And he says, oh, that's God. He thinks he's von Karajan.
this is a little inside baseball, really, right?
Yeah,
now.
Right.
Well, that good.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like Pierre Boulez was known as Charlie the Tuna because he like repeatedly had you retune for between every movement. Kind of.
Okay. So
anything to exert control over wild group of musicians.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking about classical music for non-classified people today. You can ask your own question by calling us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Martin from Oak Island, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just wanted to say, like when I was a kid, how the genius has incorporated classical music into cartoons. So, like, comes to mind immediately is like a rumble of a jungle, and out pops a minor bird, and it starts walking in sync with Fingal's Cave.
Yeah.
And I've seen them incorporate the Hungarian Rhapsody into cartoons as well. It was genius.
Truly. Yeah. Carl Stalling was one of the great arranger composers of music for cartoons, especially the Looney Tunes from Warner Brothers, I believe. Yeah. Had just this incredible knack for combining the greatest of Western classical music with the most insane kinds of stingers and bridging material to help you get from one scene to another in a cartoon. Yeah,
Martin, thank you so much for that call. So when we think of classical music, can it be called multicultural? Or is this mostly white people? Because those are the people in this country, or at least in this part of the country, who seem to be the most involved in it. I'm sorry, I'm going to offend somebody, but when you go to the Wilson Center, the North Carolina Symphony,
you don't see a lot of diversity.
It's a lot of white people.
Yeah, it is. And if you think about the history of the country and how a young musician gets started in this country, we don't have, like in Germany, for instance, we don't have city-sponsored music schools. So one has to be growing up in a family that it can afford the lessons and the instruments.
So it's a class issue.
It has been a class issue. I think that is starting to shift as we have more diversity in our economic – how do you express that? So as economics have improved for all races in this country, so has that opportunity spread. But it is one thing we can look at in terms of the gap between advantage and disadvantage, right? And so it's really rare, for example, to find, different races in this country playing classical music, right? Because of that.
Bob Workman.
Yeah, it's sobering, actually, to think of it in terms of class and race and economics.
But it really is, because the people in this country who come from the most money, right, and have the most education are the ones more likely to be into classical music.
Barbara touched on it, and it does, in fact, require resources. It's, it's like engaging in any sport. It involves time. It requires money for the instrument. Parent involvement on a very deep level.
That's why things like Dreams is so fantastic.
Dreams of Wilmington.
Dreams of Wilmington. It gives children an opportunity to be exposed to these things. Although I'm sad that they don't have someone there yet or an interest in, say, string playing. And that may very well change as we have really gotten more and more string players in our community who are teaching.
WQXR published a study, actually grabbed from the journal Poetics, surveyed 2,250 Americans about 15 different musical genres and whether they liked, disliked, or had mixed feelings about the genres. The results showed that classical music is increasingly disliked by high-status young people. Highly educated young people associate classical music essentially with the high-status music of their parents and grandparents. That leads them to say they dislike it. So there's a perception there, too.
I think that's because of that snobbish tradition that we talked about in the beginning, that you know, only people of a certain class could attend classical music concerts. Now that's changing, trying to, as presenters like Chamber Music Wilmington, in the whole country, we're trying to put classical music in the alternate venues outside of the concert hall to say, this is accessible, you're going to like it, we just want to provide it so you have that experience of what it is, because of that perception, or the fact that people always wore tuxedos or tails when they performed, right? That's sort of off-putting, right? It already speaks to a kind of formality and an exclusivity. And so those trends are really ending in this country, and that the performers speak from the stage and want to talk to the audience, not down to them, but they want to share, you know, what their understanding is of the piece and what they like about the piece. And I think bringing those kinds of things into the performance of classical music is really helping change those kind of old stereotypes.
Bob Workman, at this recent, to use this again, this example of the North Carolina Symphony playing Beethoven's Ninth, that's what got people to buy tickets to that concert. But the first half was something else that was by a more modern composer. Mm-hmm. And I heard people during halftime, I think you classical music folks call it intermission, they were saying, oh, I didn't much care for that piece. What was that? That was it. So talk to us about how and why conductors try to shoehorn in some of these less popular pieces and then save.
Oh, you know, and I think Barbara can speak to this even better than I can. You know, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony is what we call contract renewal music. It's it's a monumental piece of art, but the fact is it is so appealing on so many different levels that audiences will go to a concert hall to hear that piece no matter what else is on the program. And it is a strategy on the part of a conductor or a programming committee at a symphony orchestra to put something unknown and new in that same program in the hopes that one might encourage or inspire listening to more contemporary music. Would you not agree that that's?
I think that's true. And I think then it becomes even more essential that if you're going to program a piece of contemporary music with something as monumental as Beethoven's Ninth, it better darn be fabulous. And, you know, just don't put something on there because it fits the mold of contrast, but it has to be fabulous, right?
Otherwise,
people go, wow, Beethoven really knew what he was doing. What happened to composers today? That was awful.
Quickly, Brett writes, I attended a recent Wilmington Orchestra performance at the Wilson Center. Sound was superb. The lighting was sterile with no emotion or dynamic, actually annoyingly bright. I can't even recall a spotlight on the concert violinist. Can this be discussed? How about some fog and strobe?
Yeah, people are experimenting in concert halls, you know.
It's true.
Go out to L.A. The L.A. Symphony's doing a lot of that, right?
Barbara McKenzie of Chamber Music Wilmington, quickly, what do you have coming up?
Well, this is such an appropriate conversation because for Chamber Music Wilmington's direction this year, we've had you know, passion, excitement, intimacy is our tagline. And we've had, you know, music among friends is our tagline. And this year we just decided, dang it, we're just going to say classical music for everyone. And if people look at our brochure, we've got somebody in a kilt and we've got multicultural and, I mean, you know, multiracial and kids and old people. And they're all jumping for joy because really I want people to know that there's joy in this music and it will touch your heart and you will be inspired.
And we will put those details on our website. That's this edition of Coastline. Barbara McKenzie, Bob Workman, thank you both so much for joining us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank
you. Great.
Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Today's show was engineered by Caleb Covington. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast or find it on the WHQR app. Or tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 2. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.